Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. So it's Tuesday, October 27th, 2015, and I'm Josephine Ensign here with Heather Barr at the Jack Straw Studios. And Heather, as we were talking a little bit, this is for the Skid Road Project, which is really looking at increasing our understanding of the complexities of charity care, and specifically charity health care in King County. And as you know, health very widely defined, including social determinants of health. So the first question I have for you is, what led you to the work that you do?
Oh.
How did you get here?
Well, I didn't want to be a nurse when I was a young girl. That wasn't it. But I did have a kind of a heart for social justice as a little girl. My grandmother had a home for kids who had what we called then mental retardation. So they were children who normally would have been at state institutions, but their parents thought that this sort of country prosaic setting would be a nice alternative to the sort of bedlam-like conditions of the state institutions back in New England. And she had room for about 16 or 17 kids who had varying types of disabilities. And it wasn't a lovely place. It was kind of Charles Dickens meets John Irving sort of situation there. And I knew that the world was not exactly a level playing field for people, that I understood I had parents and access to side setting. And these kids were just basically kind of locked up. Sometimes spending most of their days in cribs or playpens and not really interacting or in any way, shape, or form mainstreamed. But I would go over there and play with the most functional kids and also participated in the care that my aunt and my mother were sort of roped into providing under the watch of my grandmother, who wasn't a particularly kind person in many ways. So I think that influenced my some kind of a desire to make things right for people who had it really rough. And then more specifically, I was working at University of Washington, and a nurse who just happened to be a float there said, you know, you always seem to like the guys who have prickly personalities and the people with addictions, and I think you might like working in the jail. And I said, oh, really? And I said, do you work there? And she said, yeah, it's kind of fun, very autonomous, and you meet all kinds of people. And I said, okay. And I went over there and applied for a job, and I got a job at the jail. And while I was at the jail, I met another nurse who said, what do you want to do with your career? Anyway, what are you aiming for? And I said, well, I like working with people who have alcoholism and just substance use problems and mental illness and kind of older, kind of crotchety guys. And she said, well, I've got a great job for you. I'm leaving my job at the TB clinic and you should come take that. And here's the woman's phone number, give her a call. And so I called and I spoke to Ann Elarth, who was the head nurse over there. And she looked at me real earnestly and said, can you start tomorrow? My nurse broke her arm. We'll do the paperwork later. That was back in the day when, you know, the public health department was a little bit more lax and actually people smoked at their desk back then. So it was a long time ago. Paperwork was put aside. I started working, got paid, you know, later on. And I worked there for 6 years and encountered, you know, people who were my type of person, I guess you could say, the type that I had described at the jail, and quite a number of Native American folks and others who were disproportionately affected by tuberculosis.
So this was, it was back in the day, but
this
like
is
about
back in the 80s.
In the 80s, yeah. Okay.
Probably 84.
Right. And so were you seeing like a rise in homelessness?
You know, that was when homelessness was really manageable in a certain way. Like I remember the big shelter had less than 100 people, probably around 50 to 80 people at that time, mostly men in the later part of their life. Very few kids were homeless at that time. There were a few kids on the Ave and a few on Capitol Hill, but not the numbers that you see today. And certainly families were almost non-existent at that time, seeing people homeless, except for at the DV shelters. You would encounter people who were displaced through DV. But, you know, now we have, you know, several hundred people waiting for places in family shelters or in permanent housing, and way too many people living in cars and parks.
Right. So you've seen it really increase. So what, like when you said, going back a little bit, that you didn't want to be a nurse when you were a little girl, but seeing your grandmother's kind of house for, so then how did, like what changed your mind? What got you into nursing?
Well, my mom was a waitress, and I was working in the same restaurant with her. She was a crafty woman and understood that latchkey kid would not be the best thing for me. So she got me a job. I started when I was 12 working there with her. And at that time, I had aspirations of being a writer and studying American literature. And she said, probably not a great plan. And I said, well, why not? She said, a liberal arts degree. She just kind of shook her head. She never got to go to college. Unfortunately, she was really smart, but never got to go. She said, look around. There's a music major there. There's a philosophy major over here. This one knows foreign languages, the more remote ones, some of the dead languages, and they're all waiting on tables. So you need to find a job where you can support yourself and not have to rely on anybody else. And I thought about things, and I thought, well, I like science. So I first made an attempt at going into biomedical science, which back then was kind of a catch-all term for anything that had to do with germs. Mm-hmm. And I pursued that and, you know, just took microbiology and other biology classes. And I found out I didn't really find the germs as interesting as people, and kind of thought maybe social worker. And said, that would be all right, but maybe I'll just become a nurse. They seem to be, you know, adept at talking to people and getting people's stories. And maybe after I've been a nurse for a couple of years, I'll have enough fodder to actually do some writing. I'm only 18. What the hell do I know about anything anyway? I'm just a kid. Don't have anything to bring to the table. I'll get other people's stories and write about them. But I just kind of got caught up in it and liked nursing so much that I just stayed.
Right. So have you brought any of your love of writing into your work that you do?
No, it just really transformed her into a love of reading. And I made a little stab at writing for a while, but I just find that I think the rigors of documentation and some of the artificial ways that we are made to write sort of killed writing for me in some kind of a way. I'm really glad that you and other people still pursue writing and do such a beautiful job. But something happened to my creative processes, and I just kind of eschewed the whole writing thing after that. Once in a while, the idea occurs to me, maybe I should write a little play, or maybe I should write a... And I thought, maybe I should just go into film and make, you know, get stories that way. I don't know.
So do you use any of the storytelling in, like, the advocacy work that you do now with the health department?
Sort of, kind of. I think I use it more just for my own entertainment and reminiscing about people I've known. And, you know, that when you meet really impressive characters, they leave an imprint on your psyche and in your heart, little footprints in your heart, so to speak. And there are a few that I, you know, hearken back to now and again. And some of them I've shared, you know, like my colleague Annie Larth, who retired. We can kind of talk about some of the folks that we cared
that
for back in the
remember,
day.
Right. Mm-hmm. So is there, I mean, that's one of the questions, is any memorable patient situation, patient that you would want to share?
Yeah, there's so many of them. And some of them, you know, I've kept relationship with people, which has been really another unexpected gift that, I reconnected with a woman through Facebook who was the girlfriend of someone I had cared for who passed away at a young age. And she was really edified and helped by reconnecting and having somebody to sort of go over that period of her life, because she went on and changed quite a bit. She and her boyfriend at the time were both homeless and had been in a big scuffle, and she had stabbed him. He got x-rayed, and the x-ray revealed that he had tuberculosis, and he had to go and undergo treatment. And I was a little trepidatious, I guess you could say, at the idea of, oh, I got to take care of this guy and his girlfriend, and they have just had this real row. And I wondered what it was going to be like, you know. Were they going to be fighting all the time? Was I going to be, you know, brought into the fray in any kind of way? So when I met them, it was like love at first sight. I guess you could say they were just adorable and funny and witty and really reckless kind of people, living really hard lives, of drinking hard and staying outside. And they had a cast of characters around them that were just really interesting and kind of rough. And we had to treat the young man for his active tuberculosis, which takes months. And I was visiting them daily or at least twice a week to make sure that he was taking his medication for the 9-month period to get him to cure. You know, you get to know people pretty well when you have to wake them up in the morning and find them, and they're moving around here and there and hearing their daily stories, stuff that they've been through. And both of them would wind up in jail every so often, and they had two dogs who would also wind up in the pound when they were jailed or otherwise detained. And they asked us to help, me and Ann, the other nurse, to help spring the dogs out of the pound. And we would forward, you know, we would do that. And they would always come through with paying us back for that, which was, I didn't expect to get paid back. I didn't care, really. You know, kind of one of the tenets of TB treatment is anything to get the person to the end goal of having them get treated. So doing something weird like, you know, springing their dog out of doggy jail was not a big deal.
And you took care of them, the dogs?
The dogs, no, we just bring them out of jail. We just give them the money to get them out of the pound. You know, they didn't have licenses, so they'd always have to be paying to free their dogs. And it was a little bit looser system back then than it is now. But they get the dogs freed. Or they had a friend who had to do a little bit more time, and I carried his tools in my trunk for a long time. He was a leather worker, and that was like a favor. There was like this kind of like street favors that you kind of can get involved in doing with people. And it's sort of a trust thing, you know, can I trust you to watch my tools? And really appreciate it, you know, because there's nowhere to stay safely store your stuff when you're really on the street. So anyway, unfortunately, this young man, he died. He contracted pneumonia after aspirating vomit when he was really drunk, and he died like just maybe 2 weeks after finishing his TB treatment. And it was the first time they'd had an apartment and the first time he'd had any kind of – they just moved into housing to a little – back then you could rent a flop house down on – I think they were on First and Vine, and they had a little place down there. It was like $150 a week or something really reasonable. And just for a short period of time, they probably would have kept it, but they hadn't had anything like that prior. And he hadn't had anything since he was 13. And it was, you know, really sad. He was only 30-something, and I went to the funeral. And while we were at the funeral, there, which was officiated by this lovely young minister at the Lutheran church over in the Cascade area, he did a beautiful job, and they played Paul's favorite song on the radio, and suddenly I saw the young lady kind of look up, and there was a figure coming over the hillside. It was a Queen Anne Cemetery on Ray Street, which is very beautiful. Here comes this tall cut of a man over the hill, and she looked, and I saw the kind of look on her face like, oh, there's some history or something between her and this guy. And he walks up, and he's got 3 teardrop tattoos and these piercing pale green eyes, and he's just quite the guy in a jaunty hat. And 3 months later, we were invited to a wedding. She married this fellow who appeared at the funeral.
But she had known him before.
She'd known him before. They were all mutual friends. Yeah. And then 4 months after that, and Anne and I went to their little wedding, which was, you know, really sweet to be able to do that. Then a few months later, she was pregnant, and I was going up James Street towards Harborview, and he was standing on the side of the street and waving his arms. He saw me in the car, and he's yelling, and he said, Heather, she's at the hospital, man. She's at the hospital, and she just had the baby. She spit it out like a watermelon seed. And she says, guess what we named her? I said, what? He says, Heather Ann, after you and Ann, because you're the only straight people we know. And we're like, oh, my gosh, this is so fabulous. So, you know, we never had a baby named after us. Pretty nice. And over the years, just kind of kept in touch with them. And at one time, she had another pregnancy. I was her case manager for a short while with another project I worked with. And it's funny how, you know, things just kind of keep coming around. Then I'd run into this gentleman every so often. We helped him. I think he actually had contracted TB too, and he had some other comorbidities and wound up going back to his place in the Midwest a couple times for some treatments. But really stayed in touch with him for off and on over many years, and then really just recently reconnected with her. And
so she found you on Facebook.
The namesake is doing great.
She
found me on Facebook, and she's doing really great too. She's in a much better place. And you know, I sent her some pictures I had from back when I'd taken some pictures of her and her previous partners.
Yeah.
And they were really precious to her because she didn't have, you know, hadn't been able to keep track of things like that from that period of her life. So, yeah. So when you live long enough, you kind of
start seeing the generations.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder when the namesake will have a baby. Who knows, you know, three generations of people.
Yeah. So those are, it sounds like that, some highlights and some work that kind of gives you joy.
Yeah, I find most all of it pretty happiness-inducing. I'm very sad for the situations, but the people themselves are always great. And, you know, sometimes people's situations are heartbreakingly sad. And certainly this couple had a lot of tragedy and sadness in their relationship. And during the time they were together, they lost a friend who got hit by a truck that was a close friend to both of them. And you just see a lot of loss in people's lives. And then the trauma backgrounds that the folks come from, like, are astonishing and you know, really wrenching to know about the lived experience of persons every day. You know, they're facing all sorts of obstacles and prejudice and judgment and lack of inclusion. And that's all hard. That's all hard to see. But the stories of the people and the resiliency of people is very heartening. And then there's, we talk a lot about resiliency and survivability and strength. At the same time, there's times when people don't have any of that and can be really hard. Not everybody gets a fair shake, and there's, for so many people, not a wonderful, happy ending, And that's sad. But, as a nurse, you kind of cultivate a sense of healthy detachment, I would say. Not coldness or lack of empathy or understanding, but just an acceptance that life is fundamentally unfair in many cases, but you can't, just give up and lie down and moan about it. You have to keep going and mine those happy moments and look for the entertainment quality in relationships and be, a happy recipient of people's humor and their unique stories. I think that's the huge gift of being a nurse working in with people who are in bad situations, is you get to see how people can get over things, and you get to also see how people live day to day and find humor in living.
Right. The quirky, wonderful stories and people. So that helps to get you through the difficult ones.
Yeah. And I don't know, I never took other people's situations to be my own. In a sense, I've always been able to maintain that level of detachment, I guess you could say. I think it's kind of unfair to sort of usurp the pain of other people's existence in some kind of a way. It's theirs, and me crying about it isn't going to make much difference. It's kind of like how I feel about, guilt. Like guilt about racism. Can't be guilty. You can do things to make things better, but wasting your time on guilty feelings hasn't really ever helped anybody.
It doesn't lead anywhere.
Right? And feeling guilty about people's, poverty isn't helping them either. Just trying to find equal ground with people is probably the best thing. And I never thought myself better than any of my clients, that's for sure. And I couldn't live through a lot of the things that they have been able to survive and get over. So I admire folk a lot. I did have one other guy who contacted me through LinkedIn, which I don't use, but I got a message there and I opened it up, and it was a fellow who was the boyfriend of another client previously, and both of them had been participants on the planning council for the agency I work with currently. And it was years since I had heard from him, but he was finishing a master's degree in public policy at Evergreen. Mm-hmm. And this is a young guy who had been on the street, did some fairly serious time in prison, and thought to connect. And I think something about him having been on that planning council had sparked an idea in his mind that he might want to effectuate change through policy development. There he went. So you just never know.
Right.
Maybe I'll be
working
for a
job,
right? Exactly.
Right.
So
nice. So tell me a little bit more about what you're doing now.
I've been working with Healthcare for the Homeless Network, which is a piece in the health department. It's a project in the health department that I had a very unique situation getting this particular job. I was approached by a manager 19 years ago who said, "We're getting a lot of calls about things that have to do with shelter, safety, and health, and questions about what to do with communicable diseases, and you know, you got the TB background, and, you know, sometimes you get these TB questions. And she said, we just by default call on you. And I was supervising part-time clinic in downtown at that time. And she said, maybe you should write a job description. We get the funding for this, for someone to be a consultant, and you'll supervise them as well. And I said, I write this job description. And I said, gee whiz, this sounds like a job for this one right here. So I applied, and lo and behold, I get the job. Not that, you know, there was competition. There was one other person who wanted to do it. But I had that unique combination of having worked with a daycare team as a consultant. So looking at institutional settings was part of my background, and had a little, you know, environmental health slant with that job.
And direct service.
Yeah, and cultivated that environmental health relationship with people who I still, you know, have assistance from in that division in the health department. And then I had the direct service stuff and knew all the shelters in town because I'd been out there chasing down folks who had a positive skin test or needed to be treated or had come in from other places and was hunting for them. So, long history of working with the other institutions that serve homeless people.
Nice. So you got to write your own job description.
You got the job description. And then I got to, and it was a really lovely job with a lot of autonomy. I was tasked with coming up with best practice guidelines for settings that serve homeless people and, you know, kind of creating this position where I was providing technical assistance. It wasn't, there's no real code to enforce. And I wouldn't really want to be a code enforcer necessarily. It's much nicer to have a collegial sort of companionable relationship with the folks that are providing services and give them technical assistance and in training. So I do training on how to avoid communicable diseases in the work site for people who are working here, and how to make sure that communicable diseases are kept at a low level for the folks who are receiving services. And I really, really enjoy the clientele being the folks who work directly with people who are homeless. And then also I do some groups with people who are currently enduring homelessness as well. So nice combination. And I didn't know how much I was going to really love working with the people who work with the people. And that's been really rewarding and
nice.
Fun to do.
And disaster preparedness kinds of things, too.
A little bit of that, yeah. There's kind of another, that's morphed into different things, and many of the shelters have taken things on their own around that. But I did do some of that I've been doing it 19 years now. Early on, I did a lot of first aid training, but people are more sophisticated. Now I do a little bit more training on managing medical situations that are not emergency situations, just identifying who's at risk for being sick on your watch. And now we have the unfortunate circumstances of the population, you know, aging and sometimes moving into housing with a number of different chronic diseases that could, you know, get worse.
Right. So you're still finding lots of things that you enjoy about your job?
I still am. I'm really fortunate. There's always something new, and recently I've expanded the training, thankfully, with the blessing of the folks that I work with at the health department, to do some training on trauma-informed care and the ACEs study.
So maybe for the listeners of it who might not be familiar,
The Adverse Childhood Experiences study was a study done by Kaiser Permanente where they looked at early childhood experiences having a profound effect on people's physical life later in life. The development of chronic diseases was associated with having a score. They ascribed a score of 1 to 10 potential traumatic experiences a person could suffer as a child. And each, if you, you know, ask yourself, was I ever exposed to any of these things, you'd accrue a score. And, you know, a lot of people have a score of 0, which is great, but we find that a lot of homeless people have high scores, you know, higher than 4 or 6, or, you know, some people have all 10 things that happen to them. And teaching people about, you know, why people behave the way they might behave is sort of rooted in oftentimes in early childhood experiences were traumatic, and they develop coping mechanisms that at the time might work really well, but over time lose their efficacy or become problematic. Like if you have a lot of psychic or physical pain, using opiates is one way to feel a whole lot better very quickly, but most people don't bargain for the addiction that comes with that use.
Right.
But getting people just to move from a blaming position to one of, it's understandable that anybody who is suffering would want to feel better, and that they hadn't signed up for addiction. They were really just signing up for feeling better.
Right, just getting rid of the pain.
Yeah, so people can move to a more compassionate stance and to a more understanding vision of the person. And sometimes persnickety behavior is rooted in something that worked for the person at one time. Maybe yelling a lot kept people away, or withdrawing kept people away, or you didn't have to interface with people, which, you know, sometimes relationships are where the pain happens for folks.
When it comes back up again.
Yeah.
And before the interview here, when you came into this room, you were commenting on something that in terms of trauma-informed care, that the quiet of wanting to have.
Oh, right. Yeah, this is a nice quiet place. And you know, I wrote these best practice guidelines about having environments that would reduce the germs in an environment. Now I'm looking at environments that reduce stress more. Like
the triggers.
The triggers. How can you make a place less traumatizing for people who have to put up with so much every day?
So what have you come up with in terms of that, some ideas?
I find myself looking around at ceiling tiles a lot and wondering in environments that have cement floors and hard walls and high hard ceilings or a glassy front or a lot of metal and metal chairs that get scraped across the environment, I just go in and I listen to the cacophony and wonder, how can anyone find any modicum of peace in a place that's so loud?
And the staff, too.
And the staff, right. Too. And I pay attention to how I feel in it. I feel very tired. Just if I'm in a place like that. I was in one place yesterday doing flu shots, and it was pretty loud the whole time. And I think people become inured to the noise level to a certain extent. The folks who work there just think it's part and parcel of what's done. And then also looking at environments and seeing how do we really replicate or reflexively make environments look kind of like prison. And why is that? Or a harsh mental institution from yesteryear. Why is there so much cement, and how do we soften up environments so that they don't seem so punitive? And I know that back in the 80s, there was a kind of a tendency to, there was a stated desire to not make places too comfortable for people, mm-hmm. quote unquote, too comfortable, because they might want to stay.
Right.
And they're not going to move on.
Or people could become homeless just because they want to go there.
Right. Or they might want to stick around or opt into homelessness. I don't think that happens very often, but that was one of the expressed concerns. And I don't think that it really works out that way. I think people can move on and feel better if they're in nurturing and comfortable circumstances to decide that that's good and I want to have more of that instead of, you know, your whole life has to be one of suffering and misery and coldness. I don't think anybody needs extra punishment. I mean, our society sort of hung up on punishing people or blaming them for bad choices, when really the array of choices a lot of people have are not, none of them are going to be especially great. So blaming people for what they've not ever been able to access doesn't seem to me to be logical.
So how has it been working with staff and some of the places around some of those issues?
I just really like it a lot. A lot of staff come from the mm-hmm. circumstances of homelessness, too, sometimes, depending on the specific organization or shelter. You might work with a number of folks who have been there. And so it keeps you humble and on your toes to be sensitive and kind and understanding for how they might think they need to act with folks, or, you know, people bring what they've experienced sometimes. And you know, sometimes folks think you have to be harsh or hard, or people will try to get over on you, or they have really hard limit setting ideas sometimes. Not everybody, and certainly you don't have to have experienced homelessness to come with that sort of attitude. But helping people soften up and be a little more kind and just curious about where the person's come from, instead of reflexively trying to, you know, influence the person's behavior by rule setting or, you know, threats of barring or threats of putting people out. Sometimes it comes down to that when an individual's behavior might be so out of pocket that it's affecting the whole setting. And I don't think anybody looks to that to be the first intervention. But to try to do less and less of that, I think, is a good goal. And come to people with that. I love one of the tenets of trauma-informed care is to ask yourself not what's wrong with that guy, but what happened to that person? And then furthermore, what is it about what this provocative behavior that I'm seeing or reacting to was useful for that person at one time?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that liberates people a little bit. You don't have to be such an enforcer. You can just be another person, you know, riding along with people in their life and sort of observing, maybe helping people come to some insights about things sometimes.
Right. And then being self-reflective about why it's bringing up things for you.
Exactly, right. What is it about this that's triggering for me, you know?
Right.
And understanding that we all are, you know, healing from things that happen to us in our lives too.
Right.
And certainly a lot of folks who go into this work come with wounds that they're, you know, dealing with.
And not necessarily getting appropriate help for.
Right.
You don't always have the resources for that.
Yeah. And how can we just be, you know, without any resources, just be kinder and nicer to each other in the work setting and appreciate each other's strengths. And I look at, you know, the folks who work in shelter are so amazingly, I don't know what the word is. I can't even come up with a word for it. But some places have to sort of oversee the peace and quiet of a setting for 8 hours or 10 hours. People come in the evening and they sleep and have to leave at 6 in the morning. You might have two staff people kind of in charge of 100 or more people. And they're the same people that would be out on the street, or sometimes, very oftentimes, people have done a little time in jail. They might be in jail. But in this setting, all you have is two people with good hearts. They don't have weapons. They don't have special powers. They just have the understanding that most people want to maintain a peaceful place to sleep overnight, and they leverage that. And they hardly ever have an issue. To me, that's kind of amazing that people can do that. And I mean, minimal training and for the most part, not well paid.
Or paid at all.
And yeah, in some
volunteers,
places.
At Roots.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of times not paid at all.
Right.
And they're working like the job of a mental health worker. They're working the job of a police officer. They're working the job of a nurse in some situations. And they're oftentimes with no kind of background in any of that, able to maintain a calm place for people to rest overnight.
Nice.
We don't understand that that is a huge part of our safety net, our own safety net. You know, the shelter system is a huge part of public safety. And I can't imagine what it would be like without the folks that provide that service in the current environment. You know, the best of all worlds would be if everybody had their own place to live that was affordable, but that's not in the offing at this particular juncture. And more
difficult.
People are looking at rising rents and harder to get into housing. People are having a hard time getting housing when they have Section 8 certificates or You know, if you have an eviction on your record anymore or a felony conviction, it's really hard to access housing.
And then for people that need supportive services, that's really difficult.
And some of the supportive housing, they can, you know, kind of overlook those things to an extent. But if you're looking at free market housing, that's a real impediment to getting a place to stay.
Right. Yeah, it's been in the news a fair amount
recently.
So you talked a little bit earlier about the things that you do to kind of cope with really difficult stories that you carry from people that you deal with. And I know you also deal with administrative challenges
as we all do.
So how do you balance that? How do you manage to not burn out on all of it?
Well, I don't know. I think I have a pretty positive attitude about most stuff, and I tend to give most people the benefit of the doubt, and that, you know, I could be very critical of administrative issues, but I try to look at everybody that I work with as doing the best they can, and I do my best to explain the situations as I perceive them to sway them to a way of thinking about people that might be beneficial for the folks that I see suffering outside. And, you know, I get frustrated with political things at times. Again, try to look at everybody as either not fully informed or struggling to do the best they can and with whatever knowledge that they have at hand. I always really wish people would go out and talk to people more and try to understand what life is like and understand that there are a lot of people who can't just get a job or just go get a place to live, and it's much more complicated than that. And that I think that I'm more frustrated with that sort of attitude than anything else. But I come around to trying to be compassionate to everybody, including people for whom it doesn't come as naturally. And I think that keeps me more sunny side up usually. And just the day-to-day work has to be done, and I don't give in to feeling real sad or depressed about stuff, generally speaking. I've been really blessed with a fairly happy constitution. And also, you know, I have friends who are in this work that I can talk to and share with, and the folks who are experiencing the situation can talk to about, you know, politics and why things are the way they are, and listen to them. I don't have anything to complain about personally when I think about what other people are going through, so I think that kind of keeps me in a balance too.
Right.
Not that it's not frustrating. There are frustrations, but I think just keeping on, keeping on helps.
So it almost sounds like you use some of your trauma-informed care even for people that you work with.
Oh, yeah. There's that. You have to look at everybody and wonder what happened to them, what's wrong with them. Even, you know, people of the hierarchy, you have to wonder what happened to them.
And try to have some compassion.
I don't think compassion is reserved just for, you know, people you think need or deserve compassion. Everybody needs and deserves compassion. Even those, the ones who challenge you the most are probably the ones that are the ones worth really meditating on and thinking about and trying to come to a compassionate stance for them. It's hard sometimes, but yeah, it's what you're here for, to grow and learn and get better at stuff.
Right. Nice. So are there things that I haven't asked you that you would want to say, or like especially things like for up-and-coming nursing students, health science students that you would want to pass on, like some wisdom that you wish you had known when you were younger?
I think you can't overplay institutional or generational trauma and the trauma that our institutions have levied on people. I like the question, what happened to the person, rather than what's wrong with them. But a woman that works in the county, Sheila Capistani, she said something that stuck with me, which is we have to also ask what was done to these people institutionally, especially institutionalized racism, and what role has that played in people's lives, and why are certain demographic groups more represented among homelessness than they are demographically in King County. For instance, African-American folk, 8% of the county population, but something like 30 to 40% of the homeless population, and which is egregious and not acceptable.
Right, and Native American as well.
Native Americans also like 2% of the population or 3% and overrepresented like 20% of the homeless population. That's not all right. That's really not okay. Those sorts of things probably frustrate me more and make me more upset because it's more embedded in our history and in the institutions and the systems that maintain that oppression. And I guess I get frustrated sometimes when people can't grasp that concept. And I feel like the coming generations are a little bit better at understanding that. Maybe the conversation's been happening more so people understand it better. But I think everybody who goes into healthcare ought to submerge themselves in a self inventory to see where their biases are and to look at that as a safety precaution to not hurt people, to really try to understand your biases and address that and wonder about yourself why you react to certain people certain ways or preconceived ideas you might have about people. And I think it's really, you know, talking about compassion, I think that's part of being compassionate is being able to compassionately for yourself look at your biases and address them. And I wish that I'd had help with that earlier in my life. So I'm always happy to talk to people about those things,
right.
You know, as I mentor younger nurses and talk about the social determinants of health that you mentioned earlier, and to see how our society has, you know, played into the oppression of certain people and into the poor health of a lot of the people who we share this country with. And they share their country with us.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think they, looking back, if I could do it over again, I would maybe during the time I was coming up, there weren't so many things available. But right now, I would say everybody should read Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson. Everybody should undertake Undoing Institutionalized Racism. People should avail themselves of groups that are working on addressing white privilege if you're a white person. And I think, you know, there's no place for prejudice, bias, and racism in medicine and nursing. We really should work hard at getting rid of that and making it a better place for everybody.
Nice. So anything else that you can think of that you wish I'd asked you about at all?
No. Maybe, I don't know, what song have you got on your mind? What have you got on your mind today, Josephine? Playing a song? You got the headphones on. It looks like you're ready to listen to music.
I'm so happy to be able to sit down and talk with you because you helped to influence my work when I, you know, first got here in Seattle.
That's a huge compliment because you do wonderful work, and I've always just really admired you, and I thought you were the one influencing me, so that's good to know. It's
mutual.
A mutual influence. Great. Thank you so much for letting me talk to you. It's been really great, and I hope you got to talk to a lot of other people who have brought some good Skid Road stories.
Right. Skid Road stories. So thank you so much for taking time today.
Thank you.